John McGuire is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. We are delighted and honored by that. We were talking about the tension between the public and the private, the action and the thinking. Bill Russell, you wanted to pick that further?
No, I was listening to you and smiling. These names will remain, these people will remain anonymous. We had a good friend who was in a very high position in the government who said, you know, I've learned that when I'm talking, I don't fall asleep.
I also don't listen, he says.
Which also means that I've quit listening as much. But he's doing the kind of thing, you know, just constantly. And then a story a friend told about a good friend, a colleague of his, who is doing really important scientific work and getting a lot of recognition for that work. And all of a sudden, he's not doing the work anymore. He is out doing speeches, and he's supervising a lab and things and things and things. And it seems, again, that this, and it goes back to something you said earlier, that balance. That somehow or other we've become extremists. We've also become spectators. Most of us are spectators, and the ones that aren't have become extremists.
and add to the litany, Bill, specialists.
Yeah.
That is to say, it seems the society honors the refinement of some relatively narrow skill to a very high point, so that recognition comes for the person who's developed that skill to the highest point. And it contrasts that when we talked about a science person. I thought of Carl Sagan, who marvelously, to my way of thinking, continued throughout his much too short life, pioneering work in astronomy. And so astronomers recognize he's really he's the real thing. His professorship is not in scientific thinking or philosophy of science. It is in astronomical science. But he did novels. He wrote long narrative poems, and had in that and was as you know one of the greatest growing critics of militarism in the United States, particularly at the height of the Cold War, just decrying this pointless standoff between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So there are people like Carl Sagan, people like Howard Zinn, who have kept a university professorship very respectably, not only great teachers, that is, expositors of their craft, but keep doing fresh work. John Hope Franklin, more active on the scholarly side and yet accepts President Clinton's chairmanship of the Initiative on Race and throws himself into that. So there are people who do the balance, but I think at a real cost to themselves physically.
Listening to you say that raises this, you know, part of this has to do with what we as a culture, as a society, as a political entity value. And what form those valuations take? You know, is it public adulation? Is it satisfaction with the quality of the work you do? Is it money? And it would seem that some of what we're describing is a manifestation of those things that we value. And it seems that it has become relatively parochial. That specialization, people, I think, tend to specialize because they get paid more.
Well, I think the political counterpart to over-specialization in the academy or even in the work world is special interest politics. Mm-hmm. So that one of the hollowest phrases I hear is a politician whose concern is for himself and his group, speaking about the American people this, the American people that, when you know that the speaker is concerned for a narrow, a small group, maybe immensely powerful group, but not speaking for the whole, using the rhetoric of inclusion and the American people, when in fact the politics, and I think that analysis that people give that probably elections are won at the national level by someone who appears to find the center for just a minute and get just enough people to join in that center position to squeak through. But I think our last national election is a parable of the end game. I mean, that's the screaming end of that kind of politics.
Well, and the Carter Center is here in Atlanta, and the Carter Center goes around about the world supervising elections and helping people move toward a democracy, and they say they will not supervise an election in this country. We don't.
No, what they say is that we do not meet the qualifications. Well, I'm not sure they've said they wouldn't.
Right.
Well,
they will not
because they cannot because they don't meet the we don't meet the minimum criterion. But this also goes back to you know what we were talking about earlier and the work and a lot of the work you're doing now, which is a lot of, you know, politics and community are virtually impossible to separate unless you have these very narrow parochial self-interests.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, the work you are now doing all these years later, looking like an activist, is trying to somehow or other bring those communities together.
Right.
And I want to know how to do that.
Well, my great political hero, Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. All politics is local. We think that if the only options are for them top down or the bottom up, you better go bottom up. And so our work is with communities that are at a state of ripeness or readiness through some years of effort and struggle already having taken place, but now want to take a next major step and develop a capacity to transform their regions. And so we work with them, and thus far we are working on a year-round basis. Their work is year-round, continuous, in Seattle, Albuquerque, New Orleans, and Broward County, Florida, and Fort Lauderdale, but that's a tri-county operation there. We have lots of happy pressure to do more work on the West Coast, and so given the fact that we're headquartered in California, we'll probably launch within the next 6 months a training institute, as we call it, in either the Bay Area or Sacramento, the state's capital. A similar kind of pressure for the Baltimore-Washington area.
Give a little commercial here. Give us the formal name and the mission.
The work is done by a merger of the Institute for Democratic Renewal, which was established in Claremont in 1998 when I stepped down as president, and Project Change, which was the most important corporate initiative in the anti-racism area that we've ever seen. Levi Strauss, over a 10-year period, put about $10 million into this effort in certain cities where it then had factories, Valdosta, Knoxville, El Paso, Albuquerque. And so its longtime director, Shirley Strong, and I decided in 2002 that we should merge and have a joint anti-racism venture. So the name is simply Institute for Democratic Renewal / Project Change, a joint anti-racism venture. The principal activity of the venture is something called the National Network of Anti-Racism Community Organizing Training Institutes. Narty. But we do have a model, and that is it begins with a community deciding the three or at most four areas of the most glaring disparities and injustices and inequities in their region, in their community, and deciding that the way to do something about it is to first bring people intergenerational, cross-race, cross-cultural, all together for a common training and analysis, historical understanding. And there we rely on the People's Institute in New Orleans, which is the foremost undoing racism trainer, has been at it for nearly 30 years in this country, grew out of the Southern sharecropper, organizing farm labor, so forth and so on, but really does a marvelous intellectual analysis of institutional and structural racism. Everybody goes through that intensive weekend of training. The very next weekend, or the one afterwards, they come back together again as a group of 25 to 40, And they gathered that time around a subject. It could be small business development and the glaring or inequitable lending, fair lending, anti-predatory, and it could be a nest of economic issues. It could be disparities in healthcare delivery. It could be the wretched situation of our public schools. It could be police-community relations or the whole issue of law and justice. But at any rate, over time, these centers or institutes develop about four curricula or four subject matter areas which they offer on a cycle. When we originally started, we thought, well, we'll offer one subject every 4 months and do 4 years, every 3 months and do four different ones. We found now we build up momentum by doing one subject maybe 3-4 consecutive months, at the end of which you've got over 100 people in the community who've been both trained, and we always end in with community organizing. Back to our subject, what do you do about it? I thought of a wonderful Valerie, I think it was, once said, true piety begins in prayer and ends in politics. And there we are. That is the arc. So each of these, and so we now, in our second full year of operation, have in these regions several hundred people in each who've been trained in undoing racism as it pertains to a specific area of our society and are now in organized activities. I'll give you one more little example, and that is just last week, Governor Richardson in New Mexico signed an anti-predatory lending bill, which is the result of a subject identified by our institute a little less than 2 years ago as the most glaring inequity for people of color in New Mexico. They did the study, they organized and pushed the bill through against the enormous pressure of the banks. You can be sure of that. So I could give you other examples, but if we don't begin in prayer, we do end in politics.
It's also worth saying that New Mexico, this is just the real politic of it, is the first state in the country where the non-whites are in a majority.
That's right.
And I think that must be part of it.
Yeah.
There is movement, as the doc would say, Dr. Martin Luther King. This is Dr. John McGuire. We are delighted to have him with us on the Paula Gordon Show. He'll be with us when we return. Please do be with us, too.